So I'm Scott Gurry, and I produce this daily hour-long show, Pacificus Peace Watch, which airs here on PFW at 6 p.m. every evening. It's a daily news magazine program, so it's a combination of interviews and commentaries and reporter pieces, you know, from correspondents all over, and a little bit of music, political satire, a little bit of everything. And it's actually ending this week, and they're going to begin a new program next month, a new half-hour program that'll be a little bit different. We're still working out the details. So I've done, you know, right now I'm, you know, working in my capacity as a producer, but I've also done some reporting for a bunch of different places, WNYC, the NPR station in New York, at WBAI, the Pacifica station in New York. I lived for 3 months in Costa Rica and worked at Radio for Peace International. It's a shortwave radio station, and I have some video experience as well.
What's your relationship to the media movements? Because you've been pretty active in that.
Basically, you know, as far as, I guess, the media democracy movement with everything that went on with Pacifica and so forth. I guess I started out, and not just in relation to media, but in relation to a lot of the issues that I'm covering now, I started out as, I guess, a quote-unquote activist, and I've sort of decided to focus my energy mostly on media and on doing radio, making radio, and not so much, you know, protesting or doing anything like that myself, but just, you know, covering these issues, getting these voices out there, and not, you know, not purely covering political things. Sometimes I like doing documentary, you know, style, some of the things I'm going to play you tonight, just getting people's voices out there, people's voices that you wouldn't necessarily hear, and really trying to sort of document what people, how people live, you know, what people do, and just bringing these voices to the airwaves, I think is really fascinating and really important. And when you really, you know, delve into it, so many people have so many different stories to tell that you'd never know about if you know, you don't really strike up a conversation. And just people sitting on the bus, people, you know, you pass on the street. It could be really fascinating. So that's what I try to do in my work. And, you know, as a, what I've done here with this show, it's a little difficult to do a lot of that because I'm mostly sitting, you know, in my cubicle on the phone all day, you know, booking segments and doing all that. But what I really like to do when I'm given the opportunity is to really go out and meet with people, hear their stories, and you know, be creative and you know, do things more like, you know, some of what I'm going to play. Okay, so I'm going to start out by playing this piece that I had taken some courses about a year or two ago in radio documentary, this little tiny school with 26 people up in Portland, Maine. And this is a piece that I produced. It was on Maine Public Radio, and then they had a shorter version of it that was on All Things Considered on NPR. So I want, I'm going to play this, and I want people, as you're listening, I don't know if people have like pen or paper or anything, just or at least make a mental note of things that, you know, what sort of makes this different from sort of an average report, you know, reporterly type of piece that you'd hear, you know, on the radio, either whether on PFW, on television, anywhere. What makes it different, and what makes this, what distinguishes this sort of as more of a documentary-like style? You know, the descriptions, both in, you know, the script, as well as, you know, the sound that's used, both the ambience and other things you hear, and anything else that you know. So.
Tall Barney's in Jonesport is a lot like most other small-town restaurants in Maine, but Tall Barney's has something on the menu that distinguishes it from other eateries in the state, tall tales. At Tall Barney's, exaggerations and white lies are as common as scrambled eggs. Scott Gurian produced this piece for the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies in Portland.
By 6 in the morning, Tall Barney's is usually the busiest spot in town. A regular crowd of lobstermen and townsfolk sit around a long rectangular table in the center of the front room, where the clatter of silverware and dishes mix with stories, laughter, and lies. That's right, lies. Over time, this informal gathering has come to be known by some of the locals as a liar's table.
That's a liar's table right there.
The liar's table.
Fishing, basketball, or almost any topic is fair game around the liar's table, especially stories of somewhat questionable truth.
Oh, I was born in 60. I started coming here around 57.
That's Mark Carver. While there's some dispute over who should bear the distinction of being the biggest liar, most people seem to agree that Mark is one of the top contenders.
Well, you gotta tell them what they want to hear.
He sits in his usual spot at the far end of the liar's table, staring off into space as he talks, even though I'm sitting right next to him. But as he warms up and feels more comfortable, his storytelling ability quickly becomes evident, and he begins sharing a story about a wandering seagull. Accents can be thick here in the down east region of Maine, so you might need to listen carefully.
Fog, this year, they said this fog in the summertime. Times here, we'll have 15, 20 days, just dense fog. But anyway, one day we was offshore then, I took a window right out so I could see, you know, at least halfway up the bow of the boat. And there was this gull that came and lit on the trunk of the boat there, and he walked right down. I was steering the boat. He walked right down. He looked in over, and he looked at the compass, and he flew off. And about 15 minutes later, the same gull lit on the boat again. He walked right down. He looked in over at that compass again. He shook his head just like that right there, and then he flew off again. Evidently, he got it where he was going. I never see him again.
Because this is a fishing village, the walls at Tall Barney's are decorated with plastic lobsters, lighthouses, and pictures of boats. Tall tales in this setting are hardly new. In fact, Jonesport has a rich tradition of storytelling surrounding the legends of Barney Beale, who lived here in the 19th century. Barney Beale is rumored to have stood over 7 feet tall and possessed extraordinary strength.
But Barney was quite a drinker.
Dale Smith is minister of the Church of the Lamb of God and a third-generation lobsterman. He was raised hearing stories of Tall Barney's exploits and adventures, stories he says are familiar to everyone in the community.
He went into a bar up in Rocklin, so he got ugly. And when he come out, he said he was going to hit the first person he saw, and he came out through the door and wasn't anybody there. And there was a horse tied up to the hitching post, and he hit that horse right between the eyes and killed him. A single blow killed the horse.
When I first bought the restaurant, I thought of taking the long table out. And my sister says, no, we can never do that. That is what's special about the restaurant.
Joyce Bryant is the owner and one of the cooks here at Tall Barney's. Despite the hard work, she says that her 12 years as owner of the restaurant have been some of the most rewarding years of her life.
I have so many people that come up to me, and they'll say, oh, Joyce, do you know what a service that you do to this town? They said, what would we do? Where would we go? And that makes you feel good, you know? Even if they're not spending a lot of money, it gives them the chance to get together and spend those times that, what would they be doing? I mean, you just either stay home or you get out and see a few friends, and really this is the only place they can come.
It's just part of your life. If it closed, it would be a blow.
That's Darryl Kelly, who says he's been frequenting the restaurant since he was in high school, long before it was ever called Tall Barney's.
It'd be like losing part of your family or something. I don't know why. Would. I mean, I come when there's no one else here. I just come, grab a coffee, and leave. Part of your day.
It seems like everyone in Jonesport and neighboring Beale's Island comes to Tall Barney's, from the postman to the founder of the town's historical society, local politicians, and fishermen. Sometimes they're all the same person. Take Buddy Mills, for example. Buddy is a custodian, bus driver, coach, and substitute teacher at the Jonesport High School. Before traveling his daily route, he parks a school bus across the street from the restaurant and runs in for a cup of coffee and a slice of toast with grape jelly. This morning, he's reminiscing about a friend who is one of the town's best-known storytellers and pranksters.
He used to get his water out of this system in back, this big barrel in back of the building. I get up one morning, he was going to whip up some coffee and stuff. I poured the water, was getting the water out of the tap, and I looked, and I held it up to the light, and I could see these little things squiggling around in the water. I said, what in the world is that? He said, don't worry about it. He says, you'll get some meat with your water.
Sometimes the best stories told at the liar's table aren't actually lies, but exaggerations and tales of pranks and mischief. The guys have thought about hanging out at each other's houses to share such stories. They figure, though, that it probably wouldn't take long before someone's wife kicked them out. So instead, they come to the liar's table, which has become like a second home for many of them. Buddy says he tries to never miss a day at the liar's table.
You know, you're wondering what happened, if anything happened with anybody in town or what was going on. You know, it's part of your life. I mean, that's just the way it is here. I mean, there's nothing else, really. I mean, it's either work or here talking it over. I'm not saying, you know, there's no home life, because there is. I mean, but this is where you meet up with your friends. He says, you ready for another bowl? And I said, sure. It was good. Ladled up another thing. He laid back and lit his pipe up, put his hand over that big belly. He says, what do you think of my fish now?
Okay, so, what did you notice?
Okay, I wanted to say that the theme is what caught me. When I first heard the theme, the Liar's Table. So it brought me back to a space where everything was just basically plain folk.
And when you say the theme, you mean right from the very beginning?
Right,
it was
from the
introduced.
Very beginning, it was introduced.
So
the liars,
the lead, they call that a lead,
the
lead, like going into,
you know, brought me in.
Okay.
And then the feel of the diner caught me, because it was like I was sitting in the back observing, looking at the people, you know, as the guy was narrating. And then I felt the history of the fishing community, even though I really didn't get into any history of Captain Blackjack or whoever it was. And then I felt very warm about that, about being in that space. Like I wanted to go and at least order me some fish and chips or a cup of coffee, right? And then I could see the relationship to some of the people that I've met in my life and my travels. Because mm-hmm. I did travel up in New London, mm-hmm. Martha's Vineyard for mm-hmm. like a little bit. And I've met people like this. And yes, that's very true.
So you felt you really got to know their personalities.
Because I've been there, I got to know them. But even if I, you know, didn't live there or I wasn't, you know, part of it, I got to feel who they were. So they're just regular folk. Mm-hmm. And that's what I felt.
Great. Okay. Yes.
I just noticed two things. One was that before you introduce someone, you let them talk. You heard their voice before you actually told us who it was. And you kind of used the cafe as background noise. Like, your voiceover wasn't in the studio. It was.
Yeah.
It sounded like you were in the cafe.
So it's like I never left the place. It sounded like I was there the whole time, even though I did actually record it later on, but I put the ambience behind me. They call it ambience sound, just the background. Like I'm always there. Ambience, let's say, ambience throughout.
Oh, and
yeah.
I just say one other thing. I kept feeling the waitresses walking by you for some reason. That's another that wind. You know, they're not asking you for anything, just that wind of their aprons going by. I felt that too.
I don't know if I had wind of the sound of wind, but I had a lot of sound in there to really give you the sense like you're there.
No, I felt this movement, okay?
Really?
It was like, I'm saying like waitresses, because
okay.
they're like moving
mm-hmm.
around asking
yeah.
what they want. But I did feel the movement of plates,
the clanging
of dishes,
clanging dishes yep.
so
yeah.
It was kind of a...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Yes, Selena.
It seemed like it was a conversational tone.
Made for a very interesting piece. Yeah.
Anything else?
I'm just interested in the composition, how you chose to put what elements of each piece and where, and how you chose to interrelate the whole piece together from the beginning to end. That's what sort of interests me. Actually, reverse engineering the whole.
Make things flow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how you chose to do what you did to create the piece and make it come together.
Yeah. Anyway, it was a very long process, and it, yeah, it takes it. In fact, let me give out copies of the script so people can see. Okay, so yeah, you everyone mentioned a bunch of things, so I just want to mention most of what I had actually, but I'll just go over it. The one thing is that there's ambience throughout the piece, so you know, the feeling that you never leave the place, whereas in a lot of, you know, reports, you know, you'll record your sound out in the field and then you'll come back to a studio and, you know, you record your narration there. And that's what I did. I recorded it back in a studio, but on location. This is a good practice to always get in. Record, you know, 30 seconds isn't actually enough, maybe a minute or two of extra ambience, just the sound of the room, you know, the noise. Even if there's no people there, there's air conditioning, there's wind outside, there's whatever, there's subtle sound. Just, it's a good practice. Just get, walk in a room and just listen and see what are the different sounds and make a list of them. Because there's always some sound. If if in the middle of this piece, if I added a little, you know, a second of silence versus a second of sound from that room, you'd be able to hear the difference. And it's also good practice because a lot of times if you're going to interview someone, when you arrive at the place, listen carefully to see what the different sounds are, because there's sounds like, you know, refrigerators running or, like I said, air conditioning's lights sometimes buzz or hum. And, you know, they're just background. We hear these sounds all the time, so we might not notice them. But then when you take it back, you know, after you do an interview with someone, then you'll notice it there, and it's very difficult to get out. So it's, yeah, always be aware of what the sounds are and become more acute in your hearing. And that takes a while to develop, but, you know, you just make it a regular practice and you'll get used to it. But so, yeah, I used ambience throughout the piece. I'd recorded, and actually I think I didn't record enough ambience, so in some places I had to loop it. But crowd noise, you know, which is what this was, is almost like white noise. You could just sort of splice it together, and you usually can't even tell there's cuts because it's all sort of sounds the same, you know. But ideally, you should record, you know, 2 or 3 minutes. And a lot of times the sound of a room will change over time. So maybe there'll be a larger crowd at, you know, 9 or 6 in the morning like this was here versus, you know, 8 in the morning when most of the people are gone. The sound changes a lot, so you may want to record different ambience at different times depending on what you, you know, when you're there. And so you have everything you need later on. 'Cause part of what you want to do, you want to be honest with your listeners. And let's say, you know, you go to Cincinnati to record some kind of story or something, and so you're interviewing someone out in the street. Let's say you come back to Washington. You can't, you know, it's really not right to then, you need more street sound, go out in the street corner here. Well, it's not Cincinnati. You shouldn't pretend it is, you know. It
actually sounds very different.
And it could sound very different, too. Different places, different neighborhoods, you know. So, you know, you really try to be authentic in what you're presenting. But just, yeah, the use of ambience, like I use sounds to punctuate and, you know, transition between different parts. So, you know, all the different sounds in the place, I tried to make a mental list of them and capture them. The clattering of dishes, you know, I just holding my mic up everywhere to capture these sounds, the sounds of the waitress coming by, taking orders, pouring water, ringing up the cash register. And I didn't end up using most of these in my final piece, but I had them all on tape if I needed them. I went back. I got permission to go back in the kitchen. I got you heard that in there, the frying of potatoes on the griddle. You know, the front door creaking open and shut and then slamming shut and all these different things. And like I said, you could use it to sort of transition, you know, talking about, you know, putting the piece together and how it flows from one thing to another. You sort of find a logical way in your mind as you sit down to write the script. And sometimes it's hard to connect from one place to another. And you could just, what I had was, I was interviewing, I forget who I was interviewing, and then I wanted to go to the owner of the diner, you know, saying, well, when I first bought the diner, we thought of taking the long table out. My sister said, no, you could never do that. So, you know, to go into her from just the guys at in the restaurant, I then went to the sound of the frying the potatoes in the kitchen, which sort of made the transition, you know, from just the people in the restaurant to sort of the owners, and, you know, and then I went into the owner, you know, that sort of thing. As far as the writing style, it's a very sort of descriptive style that a lot of times, you know, you don't hear in a lot of sort of run-of-the-mill reports. A lot of news reports are just, he said this, she said that, back and forth, you know, a debate. And it gets sort of trite and boring. And, you know, if you incorporate these different elements, it could make things a lot more interesting to listen to and people sort of be, you know, listening for what's next. You know, you're the eyes of the audience. Radio is... you know, you just hear it, but in many ways, you know, a lot of people, if you speak to people who work in radio and you say, well, why are you in radio? Why aren't you in television? And they think, well, television's like cheating. You're just showing people all the pictures. And I think television has its own advantages. You have more opportunities to be creative with the visual medium. But at the same time, people could be more creative with radio. You know, you get to listen. I mean, for the listeners get to form their own images in their head of, you know, based on these sounds that they're hearing. And you're sort of the eyes for the audience, and you do that both through, you know, the use of these sounds as well as, you know, the way you describe things in your script, in your narration. The one important thing in any kind of documentary, whether it's radio, whether it's literary journalism, maybe video not so much because you have the pictures there, but an important practice to get into is to take field notes when you go to somewhere. Just have a little pad. And when you first enter someplace, you know, immediately write down your initial reactions, because you'll never have those initial reactions again. You know, you could go and come back, you know, and then you just sort of take things for granted. You're not as observant after that first time. So, you know, take note of everything around you, not just what you see, but try to appeal to all the different senses. What are the smells of the place? Probably won't be a taste, but if, you know, the food, what people are like, you know, take very careful note of how they act, how they relate to each other, how they relate to you, all these little things. You're really sort of putting things under a microscope as a documentarian and taking note of these little things, and it makes the story, it adds these little details which make things interesting. You know, I'm Mark Carver staring off into space as he talks, even though I'm sitting right next to him. You know, it gives you a sense of who these people are, what the place is like. So you feel like you're a fly in the wall, like you're actually there. And it's not just someone else's story you're hearing on the radio. You feel like you're there in the corner, sort of a part of all the action. As far as the conversational tone, that's certainly something you could add to a lot of, you know, all of your reporting. Almost sort of like you're talking to your best friend. You could use contractions, which in a typical reporter, you know, piece, you don't say don't, you say do not. Or maybe not a reporter piece, but at least writing style. You know, you never use contractions. You always write out, you know, numbers, spell them out, and all these kinds of things. And once you know the basic rules, then, you know, you could break them once you feel comfortable with it. And, you know, talk in a more conversational tone. A lot of times a good thing is to use analogies for descriptions, you know, compare things. You'll hear in another piece I'm going to play in a few minutes. Just, you know, really whatever way you can to describe things to people. Sometimes you could even do a bit of reflecting and philosophizing. I mean, not too deep, but just to sort of, you know, again, whatever way to just give people a sense of the place. And here's a big one. You don't have to. I'm thinking back to freshman English class, you know, always saying, well, keep yourself in the background. I remember Mr. Casey, freshman English class, God rest his soul, giving me an F on a paper because I said our country. So you always have to keep yourself in the background. But, it, you know, when you're reporting this style, sometimes you could refer to, you know, say he looked at me, and, you know, just the way that people interact and relate to each other. Again, sort of bring, when, you know, you as a reporter are sort of brought into the piece, again, it's not this separation, well, this is happening over there, it's happening right here, and we're all sort of part of the action. Then I think the biggest thing, though, is something that's much more difficult to capture than any of these things, is sort of the personal conversations. So you feel like you're part of the gang, that you're sort of a fly on the wall. And that's something that's very difficult to capture with a microphone. It's probably a lot easier with a microphone, actually, than with a camera, because people tend to be afraid of cameras. But, you know, even microphones, it's sort of you're there as an outsider imposing yourself. And it takes a while to sort of build that trust with people and build that relationship. Particularly where I went for this project, it's a very sort of closed community. Not so much closed, but it's very remote. And I was, you know, at school down in Portland. This is Jonesport, which is way up in the northeast. It's almost, you know, maybe an hour from the easternmost part in Maine, actually the easternmost part in the U.S. It's this little tiny fishing town. Everyone there, you know, is fishermen and lobstermen. And it's off the main, you know, you got to go way up Route 95 and then cut over on Route 1 all along the coast. And it's not somewhere that the average person would pass through going to anywhere. You really got to go out of your way to get there.
So what was your initial opinion of you when you walked?
Well, so that was the thing. I spent quite a while there before I ever spoke to them or recorded them. I wanted them to feel comfortable around me. Yes.
And then when you pulled out your...
Well, it took a long time to get to that stage. And I probably, maybe I could have done it right away, but even for myself, I'm a terribly shy person at times.
Well, they made some wellies for you. And
how long did you
wait? So I went. Okay, I went up to this place every weekend for about 2 or 3 months to put this together, and it's like a 4-hour drive from southern Maine, so it's quite a trip. And that's the thing with documentary. A lot of times you'll spend a lot more time, so you really sort of go deeper into the story and you know, capture the emotion of the people and of the topic. And so, you know, I was going there, and keep in mind this was 5 or 6 in the morning when they gather there. So it's a very, you know, long drive. I would, you know, stay over the weekend, but it's still an hour from where I was staying. So 4 in the morning, waking up and driving up there. And, so it took the first few weekends I went there, I just sat there, just so they sort of would get used to me. You know, you outsiders, they call them flatlanders. These people who aren't from the community, and not that they're, you know, opposed to, but they still think sort of outsiders, especially someone like me from, you know, New Jersey. I mean, who am I? You know, this community, it's interesting. it's so isolated from the rest of the state and from the rest of, you know, New England, that there's still all these, like, British influences there from, like, centuries ago. You can hear a little bit in their accents. And even the food, you know, they still have, like, fish and chips, you know, potato chips with malt vinegar. And, you know, it's really interesting. It really is. So it's a really fascinating place to be. Yeah, I just spent the first few weekends there, and I just didn't say anything. I just sat in the corner. I spoke to the waitress and the owner of the diner, because and people obviously were wondering who I was. And then after a few weekends, like I said, I'm terribly shy at times. So if I could do this, any of you could do this, I would even drive up there, and I didn't want them to know. I mean, I knew I was an outsider. I didn't want them to know I was from New Jersey or anything. So I actually took – this is so embarrassing. In a lot of states, you could drive with, like, the license plate in the back of your car, but not the front. So I actually took the front New Jersey plate out of my car, and I backed my car in, and yeah, it's so ridiculous. It was probably totally more than I ever had to do, but, you know. Eventually, after a few weekends, I just, you know, struck up a conversation with one of them, which wasn't that hard, actually, because, I mean, they were all really friendly. You know, I was probably much more scared of them than I had to be. And this place where I went to school they just started this radio documentary program a few years ago, but they had this literary journalism course for several years. So there had been students, you know, from, I think, about a decade or two ago who had gone up to this little town and documented it. So I had these articles from years and years ago with photos of other people in the town. So I showed it to these people, and they were really interested, and that was a great way to strike up a conversation. So I slowly started talking to them, and, you know, they were really cool. And I then slowly would move to there to actually sit at the liar's table myself. And then slowly but surely I took out a microphone. I didn't tell them right off the bat why I was there. I'm documenting you and, you know, putting you under a microscope. But, you know, finally I said, well, you know, I'm interested. I heard about, you know, the liar's table, nudge, nudge. And, you know, I'm here. I want to do a story about it. I'm really interested. And they all laughed. They thought it was funny. Like, why would you want to document us? So coming into this whole situation, I really work to try to get them to feel comfortable around me. And that's something, you know, you all have to look at, especially when you're documenting a lot of news stories where you're dealing with people who are vulnerable, like people who are poor, people who are homeless, people who are in situations where they feel vulnerable. And, you know, so you always need to tell people you're recording them, whether it's on the phone or in person. You know, don't lie about anything. Just be totally upfront, honest with people. I don't care, even if it's like a government official or someone you really, I mean, even legally, if nothing else, if not, you know, ethically, certainly. But even legally, you have to tell people you're recording them, unless in certain situations, if you're going undercover or something. But, you know, there's a whole other set of rules for that. You always have to get permission from people. Also, to get people to feel comfortable about you, there's all kinds of little things you look, just your whole attitude, you know, how you dress, how you act and everything. My father sells, you know, cell phones and these Nextel radios and everything, and he deals with a lot of people in the South Bronx and Hunts Point, you know, food markets, the meat markets and everywhere. And he said he has, like, basically he's sold, you know, to everyone in the market. He's like this one guy sold to everyone. And he spoke to them once, and they said, well, you know, we had these big, you know, executives from this other cell phone company come in, and they were all in suits and ties and everything, and we don't want to deal with them. And my father goes and just wears jeans, and, you know, he talks down to them on a down-to-earth level. And I think that situation, you know, could apply to any situation, especially reporting. You just want to be on people's level. And it's like if you're interviewing someone in a wheelchair, you don't stand up above them and, you know, you just, you know, get on their level. And I mean, that's, you know, the physical way to describe it. But even in you know, attitudinal way, just emotional way and everything, you just want to sort of talk with people, not to them, you know, and you want to just engage in a conversation. And I found personally the best way to really do that is just to hang out with people for a while so they don't feel like you're an outsider and so you don't feel like you're an outsider. I documented homeless people in Boston, and it was like January, February. It was a really bitter cold night. I was sleeping out on the steps of this church up by Park Street, and the way to get them to feel comfortable around me was to hang out there, you know, with them for, you know, much of the night. It was really cold. You just had to dress warm, and, you know, so they felt comfortable around me speaking with me, you know, so I had to spend a lot of time with them. I bought them sandwiches, and not that you're doing favors for people, but you just, you know, sometimes, you know, you judge a new situation. just so people feel like, you know, comfortable around you, so you're not just coming in and then leaving. There was this analogy that this professor of mine had made once that she wanted to, you know, live with and document this indigenous tribe in Washington State near the border of Canada. They said, you know, there was this past situation where this author had come in and got done some writing with this indigenous person, and then just took, you know, what they had written and put it in his book and never gave him any credit or anything. And there's this analogy that they have in their culture of the difference between sort of, you know, flying off in a helicopter versus getting into someone's canoe. And it's very much, I think, that difference between sort of, you know, being with someone, you know, talking with someone versus talking to them. And it's sort of, you know, the whole colonialist attitude of, you know, you have something to learn from me versus, you know, we're all sort of in this relationship together. And, you know, we'll work together, and I'm interested in your story, and I feel I have something to learn from you, and it's a two-way relationship, you know. So back to the diner, I took out my mic finally, and initially, so even once I finally, you know, they got up the courage after all this time and felt that they were comfortable enough around me and that I felt comfortable enough myself to finally pull out this mic, even at that point, you know, you just sort of pretend it's not there. And you still, you know, you don't want that to totally destroy the situation. There's always this debate in journalism about, well, is it possible to really be a fly on the wall? I mean, just by your very presence there, you know, you're somehow influencing or affecting the situation. It sort of destroys the whole notion of documentary. But you obviously want to try to be as invisible as possible. You know, it's never totally possible, but you want to sort of aim for that. So what you all need to do is be very comfortable with your equipment, know how to use it inside out. You know, you need to be technically competent and confident in, you know, how you're working everything. Because if you seem unsure with how to use this mic or how to record or something, then you're going to make everyone else really nervous. So, you really need to know how to use all your equipment, just so you feel comfortable with it and you could get to the point where you could just press record and just leave it running, leave the mic there, and just have a conversation with people. And, you know, just forget that it's that the mic is there, and hopefully they'll forget as well. I've found, you know, if you just have something like a mini disc recorder where you have, you know, a long disc, you put it in mono mode and you get 148 minutes on it. So you could just start recording, just keep it rolling so you don't have to fidget with anything. Put the mini disc recorder on your lap like I did. You know, I'm sitting at the table, I just have the mic there. I don't look at the mic. I don't go like this because it's not like I'm doing an interview. I mostly cut myself. In fact, in the final piece, I did cut myself out totally. I knew from the beginning I wasn't planning on really being in the piece, so I didn't need to go like this anyway. I just kept the mic there, pointed at them, just sort of put, you know, my hand on the table, just kept the mic there. You know, I moved it slightly if someone was talking there versus if they're talking here. And basically just talked over it, you know, just looking at them, not looking down at the mic, just looking at the person having a conversation and just, you know, pretending the equipment isn't even there. And it's really helpful if you get what's called a shotgun mic. It's like a long, narrow, you know, thin circular mic, so it could record sound from far away. I didn't have it the first few weeks, and it's hard to get sound. It's a lot of money, yes, but, you know, eventually, or, you know, if you could borrow one from someone or something, it's a really good tool to have, because then someone could be sitting, you know, even on the other end of a table, and, you know, it'll pick up sound really well from far away. But it's very, you know, you have to point it right in the direction where, you know, the sound's coming in, because it's really directional. It picks up sound usually in a straight line. And even in this case, even, you know, because I really wanted people to feel comfortable with me, again, sort of my own shyness and, you know, insecurity, I'm afraid they're not going to feel comfortable or whatever, I even didn't wear headphones. And I don't recommend that. I'm not telling you to do that. Because you have to reach a point when you really totally feel comfortable with your equipment. But in my case, you know, I knew it was all working. I knew how to use everything. And I reached a point where I didn't want, you know, these big clunky things around. And so, but I just obviously checked every once in a while to make sure it was still rolling, that the levels were good and everything. But obviously don't do that to start out, you know.
None of your equipment broke down or anything?
Nothing broke down, no. No. I was using a mini disc recorder.
Curious about that. If the equipment broke down, what would be the troubleshooting that you would have done with your MD player and the headphones? What would it have been, like a jack or something?
I mean, there's all kinds of different things that could go wrong. It depends on the situation. And, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Troubleshooting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Troubleshooting.
Yeah. I come back. It was this whole process for this class I was in. you go up, you collect sound, and you come back, you bring it back to the class, and you play it for everyone else, and, you know, they critique it, they give you suggestions, you write a script, everyone gets copies, they take it home, write suggestions, revisions, you take it back again, write another script, they write more revisions. So the thing, you know, that you all have a copy of, that's actually the eighth revision 29 pages later, and maybe a month or two later.